You are tuned to CICK News on 93.9 FM in Smithers. CICK News is your news source for regional and provincial news Tuesdays and Thursdays at 8 a.m., 2 p.m., and 4 p.m. It's hosted by Dan Messick and myself, Pamela Hassan. Find and follow CICK News online at smithersradio.com and frequencynews.ca or wherever you get your podcasts. CICK News is funded by the Community Radio Fund of Canada and the Government of Canada.
Today on CICK News, with less than 2 weeks until the next provincial election, we continue our coverage with three more candidate interviews from the riding of Bulkley Valley Stikine. Incumbent, the NDP's Nathan Cullen, is seeking his second term as MLA. However, conservative support in the riding has been growing for years, and we'll see if the former mayor of Telkwa and Conservative Party of BC's Sharon Hartwell can claim this long-held NDP riding. Although she wasn't available for this broadcast, we hope to bring you an interview with Conservative candidate Sharon Hartwell later this week. Today, we'll also hear from Will Marsden, a member of the Gitnyau Nation and the Green Party of BC's pick to grow the party's support in Bulkley Valley Stikine. And of course, we'll speak to longtime Bulkley Valley resident and Christian Heritage Party candidate Rod Taylor. Stay with us.
My name is Will Marsden. My traditional name, my feasted name, is Samagik Amlachelt. I'm actually down in Vancouver right now for some court proceedings, and yeah, I've been a chief now for about, I don't know, a dozen years, and I work for the Gitnyau Chief's Office as the Director of Green Energy, and yeah, I mean, I started off as a GIS mapper, and you know, spent a lot of time, you know, being helping out with the land use plan back in 2005 or so, and yeah, mapped out a good amount of the territory, yeah, the traditional territory, and yeah, I mean, I've jumped into, decided to run for the Green Party in this election, and you know, it's just something I've considered for a while, and really, you know, excited to take the opportunity to leap into, you know, the provincial side of things. And yeah, I've been at the negotiation table with Canada and BC right now, you know, under our incremental title approach. And my view is my platform would be just to bring, you know, land, good government-to-government agreements to First Nations and reconciliation.
Okay, great, Will. Thanks for joining us here on CICK News. You mentioned a lot of it there, but obviously a lot of people probably haven't heard of you before or seen you in the political ring. So maybe tell us a little bit more about why did you want to jump into this political campaign, and especially for the Green Party?
Well, I mean, I don't know if you've heard about the PRGT project, but, you know, the other parties, they're not really concerned about, you know, the expiring certificate on the PRGT project. And, you know, there's just so much going on in Gitnyau that, you know, it's, doesn't really make sense for, you know, the pipeline to go through. And I just wanted to, as a hereditary chief, just, you know, do what I can to, you know, help the province. And like I said, the other parties don't seem too concerned about it, but, you know, with the climate crisis we're in right now, I think it really needs to be an issue. And
I guess, is that kind of the main priority for you, to stop the PRGT pipeline?
Using our incremental title approach, yeah. I mean, Gitnyau's got our independent environmental assessment process coming up. You know, political climate has changed a lot since, you know, the last 10 years, and our First Nation is Gitnyau. We're quite lucky to be fairly close to titled by agreement and titled by litigation. So,
You know, one thing that comes up in that respect, Will, you know, obviously the NISCA have really taken this project on. They've purchased the pipeline from TC Energy. They're doing that work right now to create a substantial start before the permit expires in November. And obviously there were some loopholes in terms of the permitting that allowed this to move forward currently under the current, you know, government. And I know there's been some calls to have the current minister put this down, send it back to the table for an environmental assessment under the updated act. But none of that has happened, and the NISCA and Western LNG, Houston, Texas-based operation is moving forward with the project. Now, some indigenous leaders who are candidates in this election are calling this reconciliation by economic means, economic reconciliation. How do you feel about that if you're to stop this pipeline from moving forward? This is something, obviously, the NISCA look at as a big economic booster for their community. How would you respond to that? How would you kind of cover that ground and that issue, knowing that clearly there aren't a whole lot of other options for the NISCA, as they've stated, to move forward with economic reconciliation in the territory? What would you say to all that?
Well, you know, there's so many changes to the project. I mean, they're impacting the SCADA and the NAS service systems now, and nobody was consulted about, you know, when the NISCA government decided to purchase this project. They didn't consult with their people, and, you know, the permitting thing, I mean, just, yeah, it was quite tricky. And when it comes to job loss, when we're turning the trucks away from coming through our territory, we're telling them, you need to get a truck there, you know, come live off the land. You're on traditional territory, you're on reconciled land, and you know, there's no reason for you to keep driving a truck or keep working in the fossil fuel industry when, you know, there's First Nations coming behind us that are going to get their land back as well, either by agreement or litigation. And, you know, there's so much in getting out our green energy plan. We can easily pump out 400 megawatts, and if we wanted to get to a gigawatt, that's another discussion there. But there's just so much green energy projects that we can invest in. Our green energy plan in Gitignawa, I mean, we've identified probably 7 or 8, viable projects. We had a pellet plant where the project was fully, you know, funded. We had $50 million in the bank, and then the call for power was taken out, and, you know, the energy purchase agreements were vanished, or whatever happened there. But yeah, there's just so much green energy projects that we can be investing in rather than this pipeline.
Obviously, you know, it looks like it's a very tight race between the NDP and the Conservatives. Do you feel that your candidacy attracting some of the voters' support in the riding will split the left vote, so to speak, and allow the Conservatives to perhaps make government, or at least acquire the seat in the Bulkley Valley Stikine riding?
I think a lot of folks that vote NDP, especially on the reserve, I mean, it's kind of like a tradition, you know. There's a lot, yeah, I mean, people that are worried about splitting the vote. I mean, we could end up with a balance of power and, you know, a pretty good legislature. But I think, you know, like I said, with the climate crisis, it just makes sense now to vote green. I mean, the NDP has had so many opportunities to to fix, you know, like overlap issues, to get true reconciliation. But, you know, they're stuck, you know, bound by the NISCA treaty. And, you know, there's a lot once we've gone through our our incremental title approach. I mean, it'll be pretty obvious that that'll be the template. And, you know, the Chiefs are already asking for that, already asking for a ripple effect from what we're doing in Gitmo. And we believe that with the climate crisis now, it's all open source. You know, back in the day, you used to get pissed off when somebody picked up your plans and copied your work. But now it's all hands on deck. Everybody's got to work together. And that's my goal. To bring the certainty that we have of getting out to other First Nations and to BC.
You know, obviously there's a slew of other issues, housing, you know, affordability. Knowing that if you do pull away enough support, do you think there is enough support to elect a green party, even a candidate in your riding? Knowing that all these other issues, not just the PRGT, but all these other issues of affordability, housing, childcare, you know, are high on the priority list of most British Columbians. How would you kind of broach those issues?
I mean, yeah, the conversation of what land back means to not only us, but our region. Like I said, 1,100, just my WILP alone, 1,100 square kilometers of undeveloped land. And if you look at our WILP management plan, we've opened the doors for, you know, settlers to come and start farms and pay their tax to us and their land rent and everything like that. But it's just...
Do you currently have any people on the territory doing that already?
Yeah, I mean, everything that we're talking about, it's like my farm is a test pilot on harmonization of our laws. We've got law firms taking our traditional law and harmonizing it with provincial, you know, the Forestry Act and a couple of federal acts, and going through that process. And you know, it's what it means, you know, there's cabins that could be built, there's new farms, there's employment opportunities, there's co-ops, there's so many things that we can use with the land back that can help out with housing and, you know, not only us getting our land back, but, you know, it's an opportunity to do settler First Nation relationship, right? So much land out there we can use, and so much farming we can do, keep the trucks off the highway and keep our food local. Well, yeah, just for the housing crisis and, you know, the mental health crisis, there's, yeah, so many healing centers you can build on the land, and, you know, a couple of healing centers we have planned, and, you know, resorts and ecotourism and stuff. So that's my plan when it comes to, you know, trying to chip in and help with the housing and mental health.
Okay, well, we'll leave it there for now, but we wish you all the best along the campaign trail, and hopefully we'll speak again.
I look forward to the election time, and thank you for your time.
Nathan Cullen, I am in Smithers and Gitomdon Clan territory. I am the NDP candidate. I got to get the name because it's changed. For Bulkley Valley Stikine here in the northwest of BC.
Great, Nathan. Thanks so much for being with us on CICK News again. Here we are, once again, a provincial campaign. You're going into possibly your second term. You were elected in 2020, and now we're up for re-election. First, tell me a little bit about how the campaign is going. It sounds like you've been knocking doors quite a bit in the Smithers area.
Yeah, we've been over 1,000 doors talking to folks, and it's almost like there's been two campaigns, Dan. On the doorstep, at community functions, at feasts, really positive. People are engaged. They want to talk about issues. A lot of support, feeling good. The second campaign is the one happening online in social media environments, and, you know, people destroying and stealing signs like a a really, really angry sentiment in that sphere, but just doesn't add up with the reality that I'm feeling on the door. On the door, it's, yeah, like I said, people really engaged, super positive for talking about the things that are really important.
You know, I guess that was one of the first things I wanted to touch upon. Obviously, we see a lot of the chatter on social media and elsewhere, but there are some, you know, realistic concerns here. We've seen, you know, taxes go up in the last few years following the COVID-19 pandemic. We've seen the unaffordability right across the board, food prices going up, inflation. Housing is now in a full-blown crisis, so a lot of things have kind of, you know, demotivated people from engaging in politics over the last few years due to some of these issues. And as you mentioned, you know, it sounds like people are quite pissed off. Why do you think they're pissed off? Has it got to do with some of the steps, maybe missteps, that the NDP in BC have had in these last few years?
Well, let me make a distinction. There's for sure folks, and it's understandable, a lot of pressures, like you mentioned, cost of living, cost of housing, those kinds of things. I mean, global inflation is a reality across just about every country, as is high interest rates that were creating challenges in housing. The I'm finding people actually quite engaged. It's more about tone. That folks want to talk about housing and how do we continue to build more housing. Folks are seeing more nurses and doctors hired into the Northwest. How do we continue that? So there's a feeling like the curve is bending on a number of things. Inflation is now way down. It's a third of what it was, but prices are still too high. How do we stop the gouging that we're seeing from oil companies, from food companies? How do we address those issues? And how do we not go back? Like, we have the... Just one example, just read this morning, that the class sizes are the smallest they've been in more than a decade here in BC. Well, why? If you hire more teachers and you open more classrooms and more schools, it helps make education better, learning better for students and teachers alike. Under the previous government, they closed hundreds of schools, fired teachers all over the place. That made learning harder, made it worse. Same thing on housing, same thing on basic things like car insurance, where we've lowered car insurance and then frozen rates for a number of years to make life a bit more affordable in the things that the government can control. Now, have there been things that we got to do better on, more work to do? Absolutely. But the question is, which direction do you want to head? We believe in reconciliation, that the hard work means good things, not just for Indigenous people, but for everybody, as well as the economy, greater certainty in the resource sector. And I'm looking across the way at an opponent that wants to rip all of that up, take BC back to court, create more uncertainty, more costs, and take First Nations back to some 1950 reality that no longer exists. So it's a very stark election, I would also say. There's not a lot of nuance and subtlety between ourselves and the Conservatives, but one of us is going to form government in less than 2 weeks. And that's the question facing people right now.
I guess, you know, a couple of major issues that people have been bringing attention to us. Housing especially, I remember about last year, we had a media conference at Housing Development in Smithers, and you guys with Premier Eby were talking about revamping and dealing with the housing crisis in the province. But the houses you guys were standing in front of had nothing to do with the housing plan, and we're still seeing, you know, very difficult for people to get into the housing market, especially with rates as high as they are. One of the campaign promises the NDP have opened up is wanting to build 300,000 new homes and do it really fast. What does that look like, especially for rural communities where we have a really difficult time acquiring people for jobs, as you mentioned, teachers, nurses, doctors, and also keeping them here? And one of the biggest barriers is housing. So what's the plan to deal with that specifically here in Stikine, Bulkley Valley, Stikine, in rural part of BC?
Yeah, so a few things. One is a really bold plan to make public lands available for affordable housing. First time in BC's history we've ever even considered this. Second, every housing developer, everyone who's ever built a house will tell you, time is money. We've dramatically shortened the time it takes to get permits, and we've also instructed municipalities to allow people to put carriageway housing different densification, more duplexes, triplexes. We've also, for the first time in BC's history, as a provincial government, started building housing on reserve. I was just at a 28-unit complex in Whitsett, right next door. The province has never built housing on quote-unquote reserves, leaving that to the federal government, which, as you know, has been totally inadequate in terms of providing housing across our region, especially the First Nations people. So affordable housing, our new plan has been verified, will help build 300,000 new houses in the next number of years. And we're also getting very strong into pre-built housing that is made in BC, but can be constructed and permitted within 12 weeks, which is, I mean, that's lightning quick in terms of anyone looking to build a house. So we've got a bunch of pieces in place. We've had to change entire systems and laws and put a lot of many multiple billions of dollars up on the table, particularly for affordable and below market housing. Again, I'm looking across the way with a conservative party that says the government shouldn't be in housing at all. And that to me is just wrong, that we need more housing for seniors. We need more housing for people that are having a hard time making ends meet. And the way you do that is by changing the laws and providing funding to get it done. And that's exactly what we've been doing. We're creating four times more rental units in BC than Ontario is right now per capita. That's incredible. 400% more rental apartments and houses are getting built here than in the great province of Ontario with a conservative government. So it's not about right and left, it's about right and wrong. And we've got a very strong track record on housing and endorsed by no less than the Globe and Mail, which, you know, probably has never endorsed the NDP before in its history. We're feeling pretty good about our direction right now. But there's lots to be done because housing is still far too expensive. BC is a very lovely place to live and a lot of people want to live here. We don't get to control that aspect. We've just got to build more housing and that's what we're doing.
Yeah, I remember when I first showed up in British Columbia about 16 years ago, you know, I was looking around and going, wow, things were a lot more expensive than I was used to in terms of housing, rent, and whatnot. Obviously, at the time, we were under a BC Liberal government, but now times have changed. I'm looking around, and I remember someone telling me back then, BC, bring cash, because things were so expensive. Your government has been in power for a few years. Why has it taken so long to get to this point where these plans are only now, during an election campaign, being unveiled?
Oh, these are continuations of work that's already started. So changing the rules around how cities and towns zone themselves, that will create more housing. That was something we introduced 18 months ago. Our housing plan, the multiple billions for low cost and low rent housing, that was put in place more than a year ago. These are all things that we've been working steadily on, getting speculators out of the business. We have a speculation tax that if somebody's flipping houses for profit, not really ever renting them out. We also came down on short-term rentals, the Airbnb market, which in some communities, Dan, 20% of the rental housing was taken up by Airbnb. That drives prices up for people who actually want to live there. So we've taken huge and bold steps. No other province has gone as far as BC has to create more housing, and we'll just continue on. That's more of what you see in the platform is more of this, because more of this means more housing, and more housing means more affordable housing for people who need it. And even to the point of giving another example, it's kind of connected, is long-term care. We've announced more than 1,000 new long-term care beds in Northern BC. This is for seniors and elders. The previous government averaged 7 new beds in the province over 15 years. 7. So a population that was growing, a population that was aging, while the BC Liberals, now Conservatives, were in power. And they built 7 beds a year, entire across all of BC. We're doing 1,000 in the north alone. And so that shows you intent. They were more fixated on tax cuts for rich people. We're a little bit more fixated on people who actually need the help.
You mentioned one thing there about the healthcare situation. I mean, we could go on about housing and affordability, but you know, we only got a few minutes here. We're clearly in a bit of a healthcare crisis still. As mentioned, you know, in Rupert, we've seen 3 family doctors leave the community. Over 1,000 people in that community don't have a family doctor. There were closures at the emergency that's getting a $15 million reno. That is slowly changing. There was also maternity closures over the last couple of years in Smithers, especially, and we did a piece about that. They brought a petition and a letter to you, two mothers who were expecting. Luckily, they were able to have their babies in Smithers, but you know there was a worry, a lot of undue stress. What's the plan going forward? I know you mentioned there's 1,000 new beds. There's a beautiful, big, beautiful hospital in Terrace, but now we're at the point where we need to fill it with employees. We need to fill it with nurses and doctors and make sure that these services are stable, which they haven't really been over the last couple of years. What's the plan to ensure that these rural hospitals have the services they need? Because as we all know, living in the north, especially with winter coming, it's treacherous sometimes driving this highway to get medical help. So how are we going to do this moving forward? What's your government, if reelected, going to do to ensure that people have the services, taxpayers have the services that they expect and require at these northern rural hospitals?
Mm-hmm. So not just in Terrace, brand new $650 million hospital, Fort St. James, Cornell, Fort St. John. I mean, the list of northern hospitals that are a new surgical tower in Prince George, which is going to help with surgical wait times, a brand new medical school at SFU, and a dramatically expanded medical school at UBC is going to train the doctors. We're now interning new doctors here in the north for the first time ever. We've hired more than 6,000 new nurses into the system in the last 18 months. Think about that. How dramatic is that? The last government actually fired nurses again while the province was getting bigger and aging. We've had 800 new family doctors sign up to our new contract, which is fantastic. And we're starting to see the results. Smithers is actually now taking maternity patients from other places. So we've totally turned the corner on what was perceived as a real challenge. And it was a lot of stress. People were able to have their babies in Smithers, which is amazing. And we'll continue to do it. One of the real conditions, though, is that this is all done under a public medical system. Mr. Rustad has suggested that we need to privatize our medical system. Do you know how devastatingly bad that will be for people in general, but particularly rural people? Because I can tell you, there's no private practices that want to set up private hospitals in Quesnel or Telqua or Prince Rupert. Rural people will be harmed by this. I can't believe that a rural MLA thinks that private healthcare is a good idea. More expensive and disproportionately way more unfair to rural people. So just met with an optometrist this morning, expanded care for optometry, expanded care for pharmacists. So you don't have to go to the doctor for everything. You can get a lot more done with registered nurses now, and all of those things help speed everything up and get better healthcare to people.
We just have a few more minutes here, Nathan, and I wanted to touch upon one situation, one issue that doesn't sound like it's getting a whole lot of attention right now due to the affordability issues, but obviously wildfires have been a huge problem, especially in these last few years. Last year, 2023, we saw the worst fire season we've ever seen in the country, especially here in BC, in northern BC. We still have a number of fires burning, and it's October, and those fires are expected to continue burning well into November and possibly in December. Although this year, the temp and the drought that we saw here in the Northwest, the fire season wasn't as bad as it was last year. It was still quite significant. The cost to all of this and to taxpayers continues to go up. And in a lot of cases from people we've spoken to on the ground, we're not seeing a big investment of more helicopters, more personnel, more ways to deal and fight these fires and insulate ourselves as best we can to the impacts of climate change. If reelected, what is your government, and especially here in your riding, what are they going to do to shore up defenses? As some have suggested, we should be treating this as like a war effort. What are we going to do to shore up defenses to ensure that our communities are safe and that we also don't have to suck on smoke all summer long and impact the health of ourselves and our younger citizens?
Yeah, so some context. That devastating fire season last year, the year before last summer, 14 times more wood, more trees were burned in that fire than all of the wood that was harvested for the lumber industry, 14 times more. The health effects, the stress, the loss of homes, all of that means that when our government decided to make the Forest Service a year-round operation, not just something that you start up, shut down over and over again, allowed firefighters to have that kind of stability and do the preventative work you're talking about. We're spending 7 times more on equipment, helicopters, planes, crews, than the previous government did on average. That's because the impacts of climate change are being felt and are real. John Rustad has called climate change a hoax and that people have been duped. What kind of premier would you have if he doesn't believe that climate change is real? What kind of policies do you think his government would promote? How would they prioritize spending or deal with things like forest fires or drought and all these things that we've been focused on? It's real. It's in front of us. So we have been spending dramatically more money on this. And I think it has to be the both. Obviously, fighting fires when they're threatening communities and homes. But the preventative side, getting communities and individual homes FireSmart, which is an amazing program that is getting a lot more traction to make sure that people stay safe. But then getting to the root causes, right? Talking about climate change, talking about the ways that we're going to lower carbon in this province, making sure that the taxes are being paid by the big polluters, which is critical. Not the going back to some Fred Flintstone version of the world. We need people to believe in science to be running our government, whether they be vaccines, whether they be climate change science, and trusting our officials when the evidence is clear, which it is, the climate change is real, and we need to act on it and change the way that we're doing business in all sorts of ways, and that's what we've been doing.
All right, Nathan, we'll have to leave it there for now. We got a couple other candidates to interview, but we'll leave it there. And good luck on the campaign trail, and I'm sure we'll speak again.
Thanks, Dan. Hope you have some great conversations. Thanks for the time.
Don't forget, tonight at the Della Herman Theater in Smithers, a coffee with the candidates at 6:30 p.m., followed by a live debate. That's tonight, Della Herman, 6:30 p.m., the all-candidates debate for Bulkley Valley Stikeen.
I'm Rod Taylor. I am the provincial leader of the Christian Heritage Party of British Columbia. I am a candidate in the Bulkley Valley Stikeen electoral district.
Rod, thanks so much for being with us again here on CSCK News. Of course, you're no stranger to elections. I know you've been doing this a long time. Tell us what you've been hearing from people out on the campaign trail and what are some of your priorities this time around?
Well, of course, the economy is always a top priority. I think our health care system is a concern. And also, I know many people are concerned about what's going on in the public school system with the SOGI and things like that. So I guess if we start, you know, with the economy, we would, of course, get rid of the carbon tax. We've been talking about the carbon tax for years. And it's becoming really obvious to everyone that it has having a major impact on inflation, and that affects, you know, food, affects transportation, and affects the cost of every single item that you can buy here in the north, because everything is carried here by rail and truck and airplane, and so all of those items, you know, people are paying carbon tax on transportation. And then we're getting even taxes on taxes, which is another level of, I think, deception. Carbon tax is doing nothing for the environment, but it's doing a lot to damage the buying capacity of people. You know, when their paycheck gets smaller and smaller, and so we would eliminate the carbon tax as a first step. And then, of course, government is overspending on many items, and it's never been more evident than during the COVID regime. The NDP here in British Columbia, as well as you know, federally, the NDP and the Liberal coalition have spent a ton of money that they don't have, we don't have. You know, of course, governments don't have any money; they only can spend taxpayers' money, but they're spending more than they're willing to admit because they're passing that cost along to our children and grandchildren. So that's one of the things we're really concerned about. And then with what's going on in the schools, I don't know if you want me to stop, come up for air, if you want to ask questions, but I would add that the school system, this pushing of the LGBT agenda in the school system, the transitioning of young children, either through hormone blockers or, you know, cross-sex hormones and that type of thing, or even as far as surgery and the implications of that for families and for the future of these children who are making life life-changing decisions that's going to affect them for the rest of their lives. And I think, you know, obviously we would stop paying for things like that because, first of all, there's no reason a taxpayer should pay for it. Secondly, it's damaging the next generation, and we would like to put an end to that damage.
Well, there's a lot to unpack there, Rod. I know you've been running on these issues for a long time now. What's the response that you're getting from constituents this time around? What are you hearing from people at the doorstep?
Well, of course, people have different perspectives, and so not everybody is going to agree with us on every issue, that's for sure. I think, inflation is something that everybody faces, of course, and there are people that, you know, for instance, no longer have children in school, so that may be a lesser of an issue for them. But there is a concern about the crime wave and basically the deterioration of our cities. Smithers is an example of the tent cities and so on. And the province's response to those crises, the healthcare particularly, and how that relates to drug addiction and overdoses and all those problems that trouble us in British Columbia. The province has had a very, you know, the NDP government has had a very inadequate response. You know, they fired a lot of doctors and nurses during COVID and without compensation. And as a result, we've had maternity rooms, emergency rooms that have been closed. We need to rehire and not only rehire, but to compensate those nurses who were unjustly fired. We need to end that so-called safer supply of drugs. I mean, it's unreal when you think about it that the province has been giving out what previous times were considered illegal substances, and the province is handing them out like candy. That needs to end. First of all, we can't be affording to do that. Secondly, it's not solving the problem for people. We would end the foreign purchases of homes, businesses, and farms in BC. That's one of the things that we would do to slow down this and hopefully eventually reverse this affordability crisis for housing, because BC residents shouldn't be competing with billionaires either in the US or in other parts of the world for a home. We need homes that we can afford either to purchase or to rent. And of course, those two go up side by side. If the cost of purchasing a home goes up, so does the rent that homeowners expect when they rent those homes out. So we need to do something to rein in inflation and to bring down the cost of housing.
Rod, one thing you mentioned there, of course, has been a continual perennial issue for several years now. Of course, it's become an acute problem in the province, and especially in smaller rural communities. You know, we see a very high rate, one of the highest rates of overdoses in the community just down the road in Terrace. And I know you have a candidate running there mm-hmm. as well. But you mentioned this safe
yes.
supply, and I just want to clarify, you know, it's more of the safe injection sites, the places where these people go to get their drugs, that they're monitored so that we don't see more overdose deaths. There's some discussion of bringing a detox center here to the north. What would you say to that, a detox, but also ensuring that a lot of these folks get the supports that they need, which seems to have waned in these last few years?
Well, the supports that they need, of course, they need better housing, like living in tents in the winter in the north is just not something that we should tolerate in BC. We should be ensuring that people are in a warm environment, but they need to be really encouraged, strongly encouraged, to get off these drugs. And you don't do that by providing so-called safe supply or safe injection sites. You do it by making drugs harder to get and giving these people a reason to live. I think a lot of these people, they're confused. There's a lot of mental illness, and the drugs do not help that mental illness. In fact, they exacerbate that problem. People need to be encouraged to find useful employment. They will be happier. Their mental health will be stronger. But we need to provide good mental health facilities. If people can't get a handle on their own problems and are with this drug addiction, whatever, they need to be probably have very strong, you know, kind of incentives to cooperate with that. And I don't think we do that by enabling their destructive habits.
Another thing I wanted to touch upon, you know, we're facing a pretty stark housing crisis in the north right now. In Smithers, we're seeing houses being built, but they're quite expensive. What can we actually do on the ground floor to ensure that housing costs aren't exceeding, you know, 50, 60, and in some cases, 70% of people's income, which is clearly unsustainable? So what will you advocate in that respect if your party is successful?
Well, I say, you know, because the cost of building supplies, like everything else, is going up due to inflation. Again, you have to go back to the carbon tax and say that's one of the principal drivers of inflation. And then the government inflating our money supply by printing money that they don't have, spending money they don't have. Both BC and the federal government have way overspent, continue to run deficits. That's like taking your own credit card and using it every month and never paying it off. That's it wouldn't work on a personal level, and it certainly doesn't work on a government level when you're spending other people's money and other people's grandchildren's money on things, some things that we don't need. And so government has to tighten its belt. The housing is a thing, of course, people need, especially in the north here. We really need to focus on it. So, but I'm not, I cannot say that the government is going to build houses for free for people or supply housing for free. The government is not their job. The job is to build a stable environment where businesses can function, where people can have good jobs, and where they can afford, be able to afford, you know, housing. Obviously, there are levels of housing. You know, some people live in mansions, some people live in hovels. And what we think is that we should have an economy that's going to work for everybody so that they can afford things. That this is a kind of a federal, immigration is kind of a federal issue, but we've been bringing in, you know, in, over the last few years, we brought in 3 or 4 million new Canadians from, and some of them crossing the border illegally, some of them coming through the immigration system or as students, foreign students coming to Canada. But all of those people need housing. And if we're not building houses fast enough, we have to slow down our immigration into Canada. And that has been a driving factor, as well as, like I say, in BC, the purchases of existing homes and businesses and farmland in BC by billionaires who don't live in the country, that needs to come to an end. And that would definitely slow down. You know, there's not an instant solution that like tomorrow we could all of a sudden have affordable housing for everybody. The government is not in a position to do that. And so I'm not going to make promises that we can't keep, but we need to have policy that will over time bring down the cost of housing. And, you know, we got into this problem. It took a long period of time of overspending and reckless policies to get where we are today. It'll take time to undo that. And that's unfortunate for those that are suffering right now with not being able to find a good place to live. I know my wife and I, when we were younger, we often had, you know, struggling to find a place. We rented, we've purchased, we now own a home. And, we've lived in school buses, we've lived in, you know, little tiny shacks, and, you know, we know what that's like. And it's just, you know, part of life, finding a way, finding, you know, good employment that will allow you to pay for what you need. And one of the things we need in the north here is housing. So, but building should continue. People should continue to build, but we need to bring the prices of building supplies down. The prices of permits, building permits and all those things need to come down to make housing more affordable.
Just last couple of things for you, Rod. You know, you mentioned there, obviously there is a correlation between, you know, inflation and, you know, government spending, printing money, as you mentioned. But we're also seeing, you know, stuff like groceries go up, you know, these costs of rentals go up, materials go up. A lot of this is controlled by the bottom line for corporate business. where would you draw the line to ensure that corporations, these big conglomerates that have kind of taken control of a lot of the smaller operators over the last few decades, couple of decades, where would you draw the line to ensure that corporate business are paying their fair share and ensuring that their products aren't gouging people and to cut some of this greed that we see growing in our society?
Well, unfortunately, greed is an aspect of human nature. It's an unfortunate aspect in it. Yet we need, as individuals, to rein it. We can't allow greed to control our lives. And that goes for rich people as well as poor people. Like, you know, there are poor people can be greedy and envious, even if they don't have the, you know, the means to back it up. But a lot of the, you know, the price of we live in a free market economy, a free market society. If we begin imposing price and wage controls, and of course, that's what socialists do. The NDP government has imposed those types of things in the past. And certainly, like, we need to make things affordable for people, but we can't dictate. Like, the government is not a good arbiter of prices and costs. The government should create a level playing field, and I'm totally in favor of small businesses becoming stronger in their communities, being supported by local people and all that. But the government just can't, you know, like, it's easy for the socialists to blame the owners of these grocery stores for, you know, price gouging and things like that. But when the cost of the fuel to transport the groceries to the north becomes, you know, so onerous, the prices must go up, and they have gone up. And so taking in balance, obviously we want to control greed, but the businesses also have to make a profit or they're not going to continue to be in business. I know that there's the challenge. Small businesses competing with the big conglomerates, and I don't know what to do and say about that, except to recommend people, you know, purchase from small hold owners when they can, and help small businesses stay in business.
Rod, just the last thing for you, as I mentioned at the beginning, you've been doing this a long time. Not sure how many elections federally or provincially this is for you, but I know we've spoken at least half a dozen times over the years during election campaigns. What keeps you motivated to keep doing this work, knowing that, you know, the share of votes that the CHP usually get is quite small, but you keep doing this, you keep advocating, and you keep running in elections. What keeps you going?
Well, I think the desire to see our country change for the better, that's what it boils down to. I have a sense that we have a responsibility as citizens to speak up when things are going badly. When it comes to the protection of innocent human life, as you know, I am a supporter of restrictions on abortion and euthanasia. We oppose abortion and the ending of innocent human life in the preborn or as made assisted suicide for the elderly. And what I believe is that unless we stop violating God's principles, because he made life and, he's given us edicts, do not murder, do not commit murder. So as long as we violate those edicts, we cannot expect him to bless our economy, our housing affordability, our crops, our weather, our safe streets, our children's future. We need to get in line with this respect for the protection of innocent human life. And that's what keeps me going. And, you know, in the last provincial election, 2020, we had candidate debates in some of the high schools. If the election had depended on those high school students, I got 41% of the vote. I would have been the MLA. But of course, it didn't depend on the high school students, and I don't think it should. But our ideas are, it's not just me with these ideas. These are ideas that people can relate to. I think following the golden rule, do unto others as you'd have them do unto you. you know, love your neighbor as yourself, don't lie, don't steal, don't kill. These are things, yeah, they're moral principles, but they are the kind of principles that our society used to be based on. And until we get back to those, we can't expect all of our other problems to go away. Our economy, God's the one who rules over the weather, and we need his blessing if we're going to survive as a province or as a nation.
Okay, Rod, we'll leave it there for now. Thanks so much for giving us your time, and good luck on the campaign trail.
All right. Thanks, Dan.
You've been listening to CICK News. If you have any hot tips or news stories you think we should cover, contact us at CICKnews@smithersradio.com or check us out on the web at smithersradio.com. CICK News has been made possible by the Government of Canada and the Community Radio Fund of Canada, the only organization mandated to financially supporting campus and community radio stations across Canada. You can also catch our fresh shows each week at theskeena.com or subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google, or wherever you find your podcasts. Thanks to my colleague Pam Hassan and all of our roving journalists. I'm Daniel Messick. Thanks for listening.